This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
People also struggle to, very often, to access their land, which is their source of their livelihood and their source of their food.
That was Jens Lerke, a spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, on the impact of insecurity on Nigeria's growing hunger problem. Details coming up. Also, Britain is getting ready for tomorrow's coronation of Charles as the new king, and Mali's military government set June 18th as the new date for a delayed constitutional referendum. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Britain is preparing for the coronation of King Charles III, due to take place on May 6th. Dozens of world leaders and heads of state have been invited to the historic ceremony, while millions are expected to watch on television. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
In the skies and on the ground, rehearsals are underway for King Charles III's coronation. It will be an event full of extraordinary pomp and pageantry. Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to line the route from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Abbey. Every detail of the ceremony has historical and religious meaning. Charles will be anointed with holy oil brought from Jerusalem. The processional cross includes fragments said to be from the true cross on which Jesus was crucified, given by Pope Francis. Richard Fitzwilliams is a royal commentator.
The coronation goes back over 1,000 years, and since 973 AD, when King Edgar was crowned in Bath. The first coronation at Westminster Abbey that we know occurred was William the Conqueror in 1066, and the actual ritual has changed little over the centuries.
Charles officially became king after the passing of his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, on September 8th. The coronation is also a chance for the British public to celebrate their new monarch. Community street parties are planned across Britain. The event will echo Elizabeth's coronation 70 years ago, but there will be important differences. Again, Richard Fitzwilliams.
You also had a 25-year-old queen. I mean, here, and this is a problem with King Charles and Queen Camilla, and that is their age.
That's not the only challenge for the 74-year-old king. A recent poll showed 58% of the public supports the monarchy, but among 18 to 24-year-olds, support is just 32%. Again, Richard Fitzwilliams.
I think that he realises that the challenges ahead, so far as the monarchy is concerned, it's very important that there should be some form of acceptance of the monarchy's links to the slave trade in past years. His environmental credentials are impeccable. I mean, that appeals very considerably to a younger base.
The fallout of Prince Harry and Meghan's split from the royal family amid accusations of racism denied by the palace continues to overshadow the monarchy. Charles's brother, Prince Andrew, has been effectively banished after settling a sex assault case. Some see dangers ahead for the monarchy. Robert Hardman is a royal author.
The big threat to the future of the House of Windsor is not mobs storming the gate, it's not revolution. It's becoming irrelevant. They understand that. The Queen always used to say, we have to be seen to be believed. They have to play a part in national life.
The royal family will hope that the coronation provides an opportunity for public celebration and for renewal of the monarchy itself. But it will also mark a new chapter with new challenges that King Charles at its head will have to navigate to keep the royal family relevant in the 21st century. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Sudan is running out of medicine and health facilities as fighting continues for a third week despite several ceasefire attempts. 70% of the country's hospitals are non-functional, according to the humanitarian group Project Hope. Arlene Fuller, Project Hope's Director of Emergency Preparedness and Response, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, the dust has settled to a certain extent so humanitarians can get an assessment of what's needed at health facilities.
There were some that did stay open over these first few weeks, and other field hospitals that were set up in neighborhoods around Khartoum and other areas that were affected by conflict. And so those are up and running. But it definitely is important to note that well over 50%, the majority of facilities that are in the conflict area are still decimated and closed and not functioning at this point in time.
Your report, I noticed it said that supplies almost impossible to get through to the places that need them. Talk a little more about that.
During the first few weeks, it was very difficult to get anything into the country. And at this point in time, we are finding ways to get things through different ports of entry, specifically Port Sudan that sits right on the Red Sea is open now and allowing things to come in both by ship and by air. That is the best way for us to be getting supplies, medicines into the affected areas. And we're proceeding to do that now, discussing with our partners as that what the best approach is. That port of entry is what we could use to be able to support the eastern part of the country and Khartoum. Another hot zone right now, as we know, is Darfur as well. That's the territory that is more strongly held by the RSF. And that port of entry would allow us to try to support that affected area. Though at this point in time, it's well aware that humanitarian actors and the health facilities in those locations are still targeted. It is very insecure, but still we do need to figure out how we can find ways to access those points. And hopefully a ceasefire will allow us to do that and think further.
What are your people on the ground telling you in the last 24 hours? How are conditions in Khartoum, the capital, and what about elsewhere in the country?
Well, the two hot zones still right now, from what we've been hearing, is Khartoum and Darfur. But obviously, there's great needs outside of the capital and in surrounding areas. For the hot zones, we're looking at the larger concern over the community that's caught in the crossfire, as well as the facilities that are down and not functioning at this point in time. And so there's a great need to be able to try to provide medical care for those that are affected by conflict. Additionally, for those communities that have left the scene and are seeking safer areas, we're talking about upwards of 300,000 to 350,000 displaced people who have left their homes and have fled the conflict. And in those areas that are outside of Khartoum, we're looking at other needs that reflect on how do you address a displaced population that in many ways have left their homes, do not know where to seek medical care.
And the healthcare workers, I mean, they're facing this dangerous situation every single day. Are they coming to work? And it must be a vastly reduced staff in most of these facilities, I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are people who are risking their lives every day. And I think that's a great concern that we've been sharing and has been something that the humanitarian community has been saying all along, is that with the targeting of health facilities, is that humanitarian actors are not targets in a conflict. And that's a violation of international humanitarian law. And this is something that we need to be very mindful of in this conflict going forward.
Arlene Fuller, Director of Emergency Preparedness and Response for the humanitarian group Project Hope, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. The World Food Programme says it is struggling to get aid to Sudan's capital Khartoum and other areas, seeing intense fighting and multiple failed ceasefires. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan, Sudan.
World Food Programme spokeswoman for Sudan, Lenny Kinsley, said Thursday the agency has started distributing food aid to the people who have fled the fighting in what she described as peaceful locations. Kinsley told VOA by messaging app from Germany, the WFP plans to provide food aid to 384,000 people. She said the aid would go to Sudan's eastern Kassala and Gaddafi states, as well as the White Nile state south of Khartoum.
And this includes newly displaced persons, host communities that are extremely vulnerable, as well as pre-existing refugees that were sheltering in some of these states.
Kinsley said intense fighting in and around Khartoum has prevented safe access to an area where millions of people are struggling to survive. The Associated Press reports heavy shelling in the Sudanese capital Thursday disrupt efforts to deliver badly needed aid to civilians trapped by the warring generals. Sudan's military and its rival, the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, have agreed to a few ceasefires, but none have taken hold. Kinsley urged both sides to guarantee the safety of aid agencies to deliver assistance.
It makes it very, very difficult for us to provide assistance safely. And so we continue to call on both parties to the conflict to adhere to this ceasefire and to all obligations under international humanitarian law to protect humanitarian staff, humanitarian assistance, and all assets and premises that are belonging to humanitarian organizations.
The fighting since April 15 has killed hundreds of people and sent hundreds of thousands fleeing for safety. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, say Thursday more than 128,000 people have already left Sudan and close to 900,000 are expected to flee to the neighboring countries in the coming weeks. Kinsley said WFP has already provided food aid to more than one-third of the 30,000 Sudanese who fled to Chad. The UNHCR said similar numbers have fled to South Sudan, 47,000 to Egypt, and about 10,000 to the Central African Republic. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Mali's military government has lashed out at the Economic Community of West African States chairman for calling an April massacre in neighboring Burkina Faso part of a genocide. Ouagadougou's military leader has said militants who stole military equipment could be responsible. Annie Reisenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
In a statement Thursday on Mali state TV station ORTM, the government rejected the West African bloc's chairman's calling civilian killings genocide. Umaro Sissoko Embalo, who is also president of Guinea-Bissau, used the term in a tweet April 27th in which he condemned the April 20th mass killings of more than 100 civilians, allegedly by Burkina Faso's army. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, released a statement the same day stating that targeting civilians can be characterized as genocide by the International Criminal Court. An ORTM presenter read the Malian military government's response. He says the chairperson's statements qualified the incident as genocide without any proof, and Embalo imposed his will on the ECOWAS commission, which unfortunately took up his state of mind in a later news release. The government's statement went on to say the accusations against Burkina Faso's army reminded it of what it called desperate attempts to exploit human rights in order to accuse the authorities in Mali. More than 100 civilians were killed in the massacre in Karma, Burkina Faso, with survivors at an April 29th televised briefing blaming the army for the attack. Human Rights Watch said 156 people were killed in the massacre. Burkina Faso's military leader, Captain Ibrahim Traoré, pointed the finger Thursday at the Islamist militants they've been fighting. He told state television RTB militants had seized military equipment and carried out attacks. Traoré says one cannot immediately accuse the defense and security forces. So we must be careful, he says. Let the investigators go through with it before we start accusing anyone. What is the purpose of accusing the defense and security forces, asked Traoré. I don't know. Is it to break their morale? Because it's a way to damage morale. Traoré complained that many countries refuse to sell Burkina Faso weapons to fight the militants. They've had to turn to countries like Russia. We have many allies, he says. Even the departure of the French army does not mean that France is not an ally. Traoré says the French embassy is there, but they also have strategic allies. He says we have new cooperation. We have Russia, for example, which he calls a strategic ally. Rights groups have accused Mali's army of killing civilians, including working with Russia's Wagner Group mercenaries. In April 2022, several media outlets, as well as Human Rights Watch, reported a massacre of 300 civilians in central Mali, allegedly by Wagner and Malian troops. Mali's military denied the allegation and said it works with Russian instructors, and that it killed more than 200 terrorists in the incident. Critics have raised concerns that Burkina Faso may also turn to the Wagner Group, which has been accused of rights abuses in other countries, including the Central African Republic and Russia's war in Ukraine. Mali's military has ruled since a 2020 coup. Burkina Faso's military seized control of the government in 2022. Burkina Faso's prime minister, in a visit to Mali in February, suggested the two countries form a federation to boost their economic power. Tensions between ECOWAS, Burkina Faso, and Mali rose sharply due to the regional bloc's sanctions over the coups and their delaying a return to elections. Some sanctions were lifted after military leaders agreed to a transition period and timeline for elections. But individual sanctions remain against members of the military, and both Burkina Faso and Mali, along with Guinea, which had a coup in 2021, are suspended from the ECOWAS and the African Union until the return of constitutional rule. Mali's military government announced Friday it would hold a referendum on a new constitution June 18th, one of the steps toward elections next year. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
In more news from Mali, today's Mali's military government set a new date for a delayed constitutional referendum meant to pave the way for presidential elections next year. Reuters reports the vote, postponed days before the original March 19th date, is the first in a series of polls aimed at restoring democracy in the West African country after two military takeovers since August 2020. Government spokesman Abdoulaye Maiga announced on state television today that the referendum will take place June 18th. Reuters says Mali's junta has pushed back against regional and international pressure to rapidly return to civilian rule, proposing lengthy transition timelines after failing to hold promised elections in February last year. The region's main economic and political bloc, ECOWAS, imposed stiff sanctions on the country at the start of 2022 for straying from its commitments. President elections are now scheduled to take place in February 2024. The United Nations warns millions of people in northeast Nigeria's conflict-affected states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe do not have enough to eat, and many risk dying from starvation without immediate international aid. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A recent UN food assessment of the region projects some 4.3 million people in these three insecure states are projected to face severe hunger between June and August during the so-called lean season, the period between harvests when food stocks are at their lowest. Jens Lajerke, a spokesman for the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, says nearly 600,000 people are facing emergency levels of food shortage, or IPC phase 4.
That is the emergency phase of food insecurity. So that's, of course, the phase before IPC 5, which is catastrophe slash famine. So they're, as we often say, one step away from famine in IPC 4.
Among the most vulnerable are an estimated 2 million children under 5 who are facing wasting, the most immediate and life-threatening form of malnutrition. OCHA reports about 700,000 of these children are at risk of severe wasting. Without immediate therapeutic treatment, it warns they are 11 times more likely to die than children who are well-nourished. Security in the three Nigerian states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe remains a major issue of concern. Civilians continue to be threatened by sporadic armed attacks, abductions, kidnappings, and other abuse. Lajerke says the level of insecurity is very bad, and there's no indication of it improving.
People also struggle to, very often, to access their land, which is their of course, their source of their livelihood and their source of their food. So that is one kind of main reason why this operation of delivering food assistance is so important.
Some help is on its way. The World Food Program reports it hopes to reach 2.1 million people with emergency food and nutrition assistance, while UNICEF is providing therapeutic treatment to severely wasted children. The Food and Agriculture Organization reports it is scaling up aid for 2 million people ahead of the main planting season in June. It says it plans to deliver enough packages of seed to provide families with the cereal they will need for the rest of the year. While this is beneficial, Laerke says it is not enough to stave off widespread hunger, illness, and death in this volatile region. He says only 11% of the $1.3 billion appeal the UN has launched to provide life-saving assistance this year has been received. He warns the situation for millions of people could turn catastrophic without immediate support from international donors. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of every three employed women work in the agricultural sector or some agriculture-related activity. However, according to a new report from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, globally there is a 24% gap in productivity between women and men farmers on farms of equal size. That's because in many countries, gender-based discriminatory practices prevent women from contributing equally to the agri-food sector. Women are paid 20% less than men. They do not own land in equal proportion to men, lack access to necessities such as high-quality seeds, irrigation, and fertilizers, and face discriminatory laws and practices, says the report. But in this day of increasing food insecurity, closing the gender gap in farm productivity and the wage gap in agricultural employment could increase global gross domestic product by nearly $1 trillion and reduce the number of food insecure people by 45 million. Women use fewer inputs, so they produce less. It's that simple, said USAID Administrator Samantha Power, quoting the author of a 2011 FAO report. Speaking at the U.S. launch of the FAO's Status of Women in Agri-Food Systems report, she said that although there has been some progress since then, it's not nearly enough.
If we are to see real progress, we do have to double down on our efforts to address systematic barriers. The laws that prevent women from owning land or operating bank accounts, or the norms that dictate that it is women who must care for children and homes.
Administrator Power then introduced USAID's new initiative, Generating Resilience and Opportunities for Women, or GROW. Through this program, she said, USAID will work with the U.S. Congress to double the funding to women across agricultural and food systems to $335 million.
We are going to help women build resilience to economic shocks that may make seeds and fertilizer unaffordable. We will support women to take on economic roles off the farm, and we will work to direct resources to women in humanitarian crisis zones.
GROW will provide the resources to address barriers, including laws that prevent women from fully participating in or equally benefiting from agricultural and food work, said Administrator Power. There are hundreds of millions of women who are ready, willing, and able to help us end hunger, if only we dismantle the barriers standing in their way.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.